Anna Eastman, since last year when we spoke concerning your diaries and your opinions on female creativity, women artists, and so forth, women's liberation movements have burst upon the mass consciousness in what I believe is the most spectacular way. And so I have asked you to speak once again at KPFK on some of the issues involved in women's liberation. And I might recall that when Diary Number 3 was published last year, Robert Kirsch started his review by characterizing you as the world's most liberated woman, and so I consider you, therefore, as certainly an authority and a considerable oracle on that matter. First, I would like to say that it would be very nice if we could talk about your own personal evolution and development vis-a-vis your own liberation and female identity, which, of course, has been the subject of your diaries.
Yes, this is interesting because without even my knowing it, since as you write a diary, you don't really know the outcome, I very soon became aware, and that's why I have such a debt to psychology, that a great many of the obstacles to my own inner liberation and therefore being able to act on the outer one were really in myself, in my own patterns which had been imposed on me. And the story of the diary, which has been probably helpful to other women, is that I did note the patterns of which I was the unconscious victim, which analysis did help me to realize. One was, of course, racial, religious, the pattern made by the father, made by the family, the ideals of the family, the mythological saintly grandmother, Spanish grandmother who became a model that I could never achieve, the knowledge of the interferences and obstacles being first of all in your own emotional construction is very necessary, because then once you're aware of those, once I was able to transcend the religious narrowness of the dogma, once I could transcend, say, the ideals of my parents which had been imposed on me, once I could go beyond my own ideal femininity pattern on the famous Spanish grandmother, once I was rid of those things, then I could act without this guilt or this ambivalence or this conflict in which most of our energies go. Also, it taught me not to blame others for the liberation that they couldn't possibly hand me on a platter because I wasn't ready for it. And the value probably of the diaries lies in there being a notebook of this very difficult journey of peeling off one by one what you have been taught, how you have been conditioned, what traumas created this pattern that I thought was me and was not me, and then having to find myself through that before I faced the world problems.
Yes, it's quite extraordinary how many women and possibly men have read those diaries, and although it was the story of your liberation, have been able to glean a great deal of help to set them off on their own journey.
Which shows that I think our handicaps, you know, our being victims of social and cultural patterns was happening to the men as well as to the women. It was not happening only to us. They were also victims of roles. They were playing roles. They were facing the world in a certain stance, which was false. And all this, of course, is turned up in their literature. When we see it in a novel, we know it's a stance. We know it's a persona. We know it's not the real person. But women had a little more difficult time becoming aware of the difference between the role-playing which was imposed on her as wife, as companion, as mistress, as mother. The role seemed a little more difficult than the man's confrontation of the world. He wasn't quite so concerned with the personal world. And in a way, this restriction upon woman, which did limit her for so long in her personal world, I think became the origin of some of her qualities, which I would like to see preserved. Some of the qualities were the human, giving importance to the human being rather than the ideological abstract values.
It might be interesting at this point to comment on two things I've been reading. One of them is a letter which was written to you by Pierce Harwell, which is quoted in Diary Number 3. And I would then like to contrast a statement by Theodore Rosak in an anthology entitled Masculine Feminine, Readings in Sexual Mythology and the Liberation of Women, edited by Betty Rosak and Theodore Rosak. First, the Harwell, because I think it will lead us into a rather fruitful discussion. Writing to you, he says, "The role of women will be extremely crucial. Tomorrow's woman bears the burden of redeeming mankind's emotions. Out of herself, she must create the new harmonies of joy, the new faculty of emotional counterpoint. As human beings, we are rapidly losing our capacity for real feeling. We are growing cold and insensate even as we draw closer together. It requires a more intense shock to move us than it ever required before. The young see everything as it is, and therefore they see nothing. They feel everything exactly in its proper relation to practicality, and therefore they feel nothing. The Aryan age, its end, was not marked by the loss of feeling as ours is, but by the loss of direction and social purpose. The responsibility of tomorrow's woman is to re-educate the human heart. We await the coming of Superman as the pre-Christian cultures awaited the Messiah. But if women do not take upon themselves the birthing of a new spirit of poetry and gentleness and joyousness of life, Superman, when he comes, will be little more than a Marxian gorilla, a powerful robot with a battery for a heart, and a radio tube for a brain." When was that written, by the way, Anais?
That was quite a long time ago. This was in the 40s, when he was studying my astrologic chart. He was an astrologer.
Mm-hmm. Well, now there's a quite astonishing paragraph in Theodore Rosak's essay called The Hard and the Soft. Quote, on page 101 of that paperback edition, "Saving the compassionate virtues is not the particular duty of women. On the contrary, the sooner we have done with the treacherous nonsense of believing that the human personality must be forced into masculine and feminine molds, the better. No matter how lyrically intoned, the notion that women are innately feminine and therefore uniquely responsible for the fate of the softer human virtues is a lethal deception. To think this way is to play dumb to the fact that throughout civilized history, men have unloaded the nurturing talents on women for base purposes of manipulation and exploitation. Worst of all, it is to continue giving the men of the world a solid gold rationale for repressing those talents in themselves and for thus stripping power of its humanitarian discipline. There, then, is the heart of the matter. There are no masculine and feminine virtues. There are only human virtues. Courage, daring, decisiveness, resourcefulness are good qualities in women as much so as in men. So too are charity, mercy, tenderness. But ruthlessness, callousness, power lust, domineering self-assertion, these are destructive whether in man or woman. At this juncture in our history, it is the compassionate virtues that need desperately to be given a new public dignity. But what an act of hypocrisy it would be to pretend that these virtues are to be honored in women. Rather, they are to be given reverence in all of us, for they are there."
This I agree. I agree ideologically, but I think it has happened that the position of woman, which was a restrictive one, really did foster the human qualities. I mean, it helped those human qualities to be primary. I don't think they're necessarily feminine, masculine. I have known men who make marvelous mothers. I have known men to do, you know, things that we consider are feminine much better than women. I have known women who have extraordinary courage in action and no fear at all. I do think the virtues of each are distributed, not necessarily in women or men, but the position of woman, I think, helped her to develop that side of the humanity. The fact that she didn't go too quickly, because she was not so much involved in the professions, she didn't get corrupted also by the fear of not succeeding in the world. The fact that, you know, her success was really not tied to her sexual life. That it was, her, you know, her woman's life was not affected by success as man's. These cultural, really restrictions sometimes bring up some very valuable elements which are part of our frustration, really, but become positive qualities.
You mentioned before the fact that you did not blame various people in your lives for the choices which you felt that you had made.
Yes,
and I'd like to have you more comment on that.
Yes, this is true, and this is why some elements of the women's liberation I'm not in sympathy with, is because I think we have to begin first with a self-examination and where the obstacles lie. Now, when I found that the man's ideology, the husband or the lover or the friend, did stand in the way of something that I considered my development, for example, when the problem came up of writing the preface to Tropic of Cancer, of writing the book on Lawrence, I did stand up then for my rights, but I tried to explain and dialogue to the man that this was no threat to him. In other words, the conversation with man has continued all through my life, with the psychologist, with the doctor, with the lawyer, with whoever I was in need of and exchanging a certain dependency. I tried and I succeeded in explaining my position and therefore being able to move to the next step. For example, when I was being analyzed, Rank took into account many of my reactions and admitted that we knew very little about the woman's psychology. And if we go deep enough and the unconscious is very similar between men and women, this was not done to make a distinction. It's just that the woman had not been very articulate. And we need to know more about women's dreams, women's reactions, which is now beginning to come through in her expression.
Hmm. What were the circumstances of the writing preface to the Tropic of Cancer? I didn't have that.
Well, when I first wanted to write my book on Lawrence, naturally, my family and my husband said this would endanger his job or his status in the world, because at that time you have to put yourself back in 1934 when they were burning Lawrence's books, and Lawrence was as much an object of scandal, say, as Henry Miller was a few years ago during the trials and so forth. And I was not living a bohemian life. I was living a bourgeois life, taking care of my mother and my brothers. You know, I had a very middle class bourgeois life, and certain values were supposed to be respected. Writing the Lawrence book was an act of great rebellion for that period. And even asserting Lawrence's caring about women, this is why I don't agree with Millet about that. He cared and he was trying to find out what women felt. And he was the first one who did write woman has independently sexual feelings from love and so forth. So those were problems. And writing the preface to Tropic of Cancer, nobody wanted to write it at the time. We couldn't find anyone who would do it. Since I had written the book on Lawrence, I was the logical one to preface to Cancer.
You'd already tainted yourself as a hopeless reprobate. You might as well do that, too.
But I must say, I was always able, and I think some women have been able to do that, and we ought really to study them more. The women who were able to involve men in their struggle, to really gain the sympathy of the man, the interest of the man, whether it be the psychologist or the husband or whoever it was, in being able to state your position and your reason for the position and the integrity of the position. For me, it was an act of integrity, prefacing Cancer, since I believed in this revolutionary sexual thing. But there are women, for example, in the case of Freud, whom we now, I consider Freud's attitude towards women very old-fashioned, but we know that this is the beginning of psychology. We don't take that as a final word. There was a woman that he as respected, admired, and asked advice from and discussed his lectures with, and that was Salome, whose biography has just come out. So each woman independently has been able to achieve that. I hope all the women will be able to do that, to involve others, because I think liberation is a collective and a thing that we have to do together.
In other words, the feeling of separatism which has been accumulating in the women's liberation movement, you would not approve of?
No, because I think it's a generalization. All men have not stood in the way of women's development. Women has has had enemies and has had friends. I found the women lacking in solidarity. When books would come out, there was a certain period when all the novels that came out treated of alienation. They were the men's novels. Now nobody came forth to review the books that were written by women at the same time who were dealing with relationship, the complications, complexities, the interest, the passionate problems of relationship. I was going around lecturing through the country about these women writers who were concerned with relationship, and no one reacted to them, no one read them.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the writers on Ease?
Well, some of them, I forget a few names and I can't think of them immediately, but I mean, at that time I was talking about Juna Barnes, I was talking about Maud Hutchins, Margaret Young, the equivalent, I would find equivalents, you know, for example, to the poetry of Dylan Thomas, I talked about the book written by his widow, Catelyn, which I admired. No woman came forth to defend her when they called it a piece of hysterical, emotional writing. It was beautiful writing. When books are reviewed, nobody came. One woman came to my defense when a Trilling wrote that I was writing merely about neurotic women and that they didn't represent society. I would like to see women more concerned with women's contributions than with this great battle of attacking the men. Why should we expect the men to do such marvelous portraits of women or to show some tremendous understanding of women? There are women who have been slowly recording the evolution of woman from the old-fashioned portrait to the modern woman. We should be very busy creating the pattern of the new woman, unearthing her gifts, finding out who are the women painters, who are the women historians, who are the women psychologists that we could be interested in. I think that would be much more beneficial.
It's interesting that you mention this because this is happening to some extent in this city. As I mentioned before, Miriam Shapiro and Judy Chicago are setting up a program for women artists in California Institute of the Arts next year. Women artists are organizing a group to explore some of these things. And you have certainly very poignantly demonstrated the need for women critics of literature and art who understand and are sympathetic to the achievements of women writers and artists who do not bring to bear male standards, perhaps.
No, that's true. That's absolutely true. No, this I'm very pleased to hear, and this I will always join with this kind of activity.
It seems to be one of the interesting questions, and I don't know if it's answerable at all, is there a difference between male and female? And many of the assumptions that writers and speakers rest upon this question. Do we have any way of even knowing, really, given the cultural conditioning we've had?
Well, the cultural conditioning did create the differences. Whoever has gone very deep into psychology realizes that the differences really diminish, but they're not the kind of things that end in unisex. The differences simply lie in the conditioning. When we come to an emotional level and an unconscious level, this had been my hope, that it would bring men and women closer together, understanding, because both of them understood, or each one understood his patterns, his difficulties, and his conditioning. And on that level, we could talk, and we could say, you know, this is my difficulty, and they would understand each other. If once we admitted that so much of ourselves was fictitiously created, was a fictitious personality, then men have discovered that too.
You know, in the beginning when you were talking about the need for individual liberation, I began to feel very pessimistic again about political action or women's liberation being achieved through political actions. Certainly it's become well understood that nothing can happen politically without a transformation in consciousness. I guess that's what consciousness raising is about in the groups.
Yes, yes.
But no matter how much consciousness raising one has, can it really be effective without some kind of introspection, possibly with professional help? analysis.
Yes, you see, Claire, this is where we agree that one comes before the other, that I think elucidating, you know, separating our neurosis, say, from the revolution, which I describe not only in women, but in, there's a character called Rango in the diary, or Gonzalo in the diary, who is what I call a neurotic revolutionary, because he has failed so much in his life, and he's so frustrated, and he's so angry, he would like to be a revolutionary, but he's a completely ineffectual one and a meaningless one because he's projecting his neurosis. I didn't want women to do that, to project their anger or their failures in relationship, because I don't think it's a failure relationship between man and woman. I think it's our failure in relationship in general that bothers us. And if we put this on the revolution, we are corrupting it. We're making it less effective. So I don't mean only the inner one, but the inner one as a barometer, as an orientation, as the awareness making us more lucid, more objective. That I'd like to see.
We were talking before about what happens to thought and action when an adversary relationship is established between people. And
yes.
I'm afraid that's very pertinent.
I think that nothing ever comes of that. In other words, that to me is war. I don't want to see the Mailer and Millet war any more than I want to see the Vietnam War. I mean, the state of war is not one in which people gain anything. I think it's just destructive, no matter how intelligently it's conducted. Or
something very interesting came out of this essay by Theodore Rosak, from which I quoted before. He was talking about the loss of momentum, which happened to the feminist movement at the beginning of World War I, how the feminists at first had been ardent pacifists and anti-war, you know, and had been zipping along for their own movement, making certain strides and being very committed. Then suddenly, almost within a week of the starting of World War I, and I hope I'm remembering correctly, Mrs. Pankhurst started cooperating with the war effort and started recruiting people and urged all the women to make fun of and to intimidate men who did not join the war. And so all the feminists rapidly went over to the side of the men, and thus doing irreparable damage to their own cause for years. And I think that he's interpreting that this, what they did in World War I, perhaps was the reason for a collapse for many years of the feminist movement.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that part of the history.
Oh, it was fascinating.
Yes.
I just read about that. And again, if you have just tuned in, I'm referring to Masculine and Feminine, an anthology by Theodore and Betty Rosak, Theodore Rosak being the author of The Making of the Counterculture. I don't know if this is pertinent. I love to talk about Apollonians and Dionysians because it seems to me we're in a Dionysian phase, especially amongst the young people. And there have been so many things that have been happening with this kind of giving in to the inner or the exploration of the irrational. I wondered if you would care to talk about that at all. I don't know if it's quite on to our topic of women's liberation.
I think it is, because the young have now gotten together and have acknowledged that what they used to call the irrational, which is the emotional thing, which we can't always explain in rational terms, is something that we share with men. Only man had been told to rationalize and to build up a apparently objective world. And this is why I've always felt that when we spoke about women's irrational, we didn't mean that at all. We meant an emotional state that she could not clarify, could not make clear to others. And this was purely a matter of art and expression and aesthetics. And merely the fact that she wasn't confronted, you see, with the public expression of it and didn't even know quite what she felt. Now that she can explain these, there's, I think, a great hope, and I like the Dionysian movement. In the first place, it's a recognition of the perception through the senses and the joyfulness of relationship, and it's really the thing I would rather see happen than war between man and woman. Is that in the sense in which you meant it?
Yes. The thing that I've been thinking about vis-a-vis Theodore Roszak is that he celebrates the Dionysian tendencies today, but then...
There's a great danger. That's why I thought there was a great danger in the Millet book. You see, just as we were getting rid, these men played a very useful role. I think Mailer is right in that Miller and played a very useful role in the sexual revolution. First of all, they had to get rid of their own distance from woman, which Puritanism created. So Miller broke that down by vulgarizing woman, by taking her away from the myth and the Christian myth which had put her up there. And those were useful things. Those are historical things. One should recognize that they happened. At a certain moment, they were right. Now it's no longer right. We want to go beyond that and see the woman as a total being, you know, not only as a sexual object. That's fine. But then I don't think we need to worry about the ones who came before and prepared the ground. See, part of the demystifying of woman was necessary in the American culture because women and men were very separate by Puritanism really separated them, and the lack of pleasure of the body and the senses, the development of the senses. Do you feel that that's
yes.
true?
Oh, yes. The thing I was going to say before, and I keep trying to grope for the right words, is that my critique of Roszak, and I don't know if it's, again, appropriate to talk about, was he chastises the young for the surfacing of the kind of blood drives, the violence which seems to come out when one gives in totally to a Dionysian view of self. And he chastises them as if it's a matter of taste, a momentary aberration, that if they were aware how distasteful this was, they would be able to control it. And he talks about certain reviews of rock festivals in which the imagery is frightful, really bloody and horrible. Or he will allude to, you know, something like the Manson case, as if this isn't possibly inherent in man. And I'm always thinking about the human condition, whether the whole Dionysian point of view isn't fraught with difficulties at some point.
No, I don't think so. I think that in every movement that we make, you know, in every existing movement that we've made, there is a destructive and a creative. So these two currents are going together in the young. The ones that I know, the ones that I have dealings with, are not the ones who are enamored of violence and or even drugs. Or, you know, those are the creative ones. There's always that duality, isn't there? The dark and the other. So Dionysiac movement has both sides too. We are very dual in that. Our unconscious has dark and terrible nightmares. It is also the source of great creativity. So in the young, those two movements are there, certainly, but I don't think they're all one direction, do you?
I hope
they're not all in that direction.
You had mentioned before your experience with any number of analysts, and in fact, as one recalls from reading your diaries, you yourself have practiced analysis for some time. Do you feel that women can profit from analysis with a male analyst at this point in history? Or do you think female analysts are, perhaps that's too much of a generalization, are more equipped to deal with the problems
yes,
of women?
I can't answer that. The person that I worked best with was a woman. The men that I worked with were investigating and were experimenting and were very eager to understand woman, but they perhaps at that particular time, now we're speaking of Otto Rank, who understood the artist very well, and I went to him because I didn't care about the problem of being a woman so much at that time as to be an artist, which was was the most important thing at that time. It so happens that a woman has helped me. I don't think we can generalize in that way, because whoever is really skillful and adept enough to read, you know, to read the dream and the unconscious and even your artwork, to know what, to find your identity, should be able to do that with women as well as with men. I don't think we have many Freuds running around today. And the Jungian analysts and the others have, the ones who have specialized in understanding the unconscious, I think, should not be different from the woman. Some women, though, have done very valuable writing for women. You know, Dr. Esther Harding on women.
Mm-hmm.
Some women analysts, I'm sure, I'd like to have had more time to go into them. But you see, I became more interested in going beyond masculine, feminine thing. For instance, I prefer Adi Lang, who doesn't make any distinction. Adi Lang?
Oh, Lang, of course. Lang. Yes.
Yes, I say Lang in the English way. But it's Lang, and he talks about our psyche as it doesn't have sex anymore. It's a matter of extending the boundaries, transcending all that. We're transcending all that, I hope. I hope people are not going to polarize into these extremes, because what we should be doing really is transcending cultural, religious, and racial values, all of us.
It's interesting what's happened with Lang's career lately. He had a terrific underground reputation, and everybody seemed to be reading him. And now that he's gotten as popular as he has, it seems like the intellectual establishment is joining ranks to criticize. And there was quite an interesting and quite critical essay on him recently in the New York Review of Books, a retrospective of his writings. And it's clear that a lot of, you know, attention is going to be marshaled together to deal with the upstart. Do you have any specific comments you'd like to make on leaders of women's liberation and how you picture their how you would evaluate their contribution at this time?
I think I would rather bypass that, and I'm very preoccupied with what I would like women to turn their energies to, leaving alone the solution of the political and the economic and the job problems and the professional inequalities, which I'm not, you know, equipped to go into, but which have to be worked upon. But the other side that I am equipped to deal with is the fact that we have to create now in literature and in art and in the film, in every medium, an image of what is the woman, the modern woman. What is the modern woman? For example, I wrote a novel in 1954 called Spy in the House of Love. I meant to picture a woman's struggle to liberate herself sexually from connecting the two. She was trying to achieve the same thing as a man had done, to separate them so she wouldn't be victimized by some emotional entanglement. When I did that at that time, she was berated by all the men critics on a moral basis. She was called a nymphomaniac. She only had three lovers. I don't consider that nymphomaniac. The whole thing was based on her attempt at freedom being somehow offensive. And no man has ever been able to write a scenario, a script of Spy in the House of Love, because this concept has been so strong.
Mm.
Now, there's so much for woman to do, you know, in picturing the character of what is to be, in helping to make the new patterns, that I don't think our energy should go into attacking the men who didn't do it. Even Lawrence himself said the patterns were made by men and women followed them, and when men said they had to be thin, they were thin. And we should be making those patterns.
So you're saying that it's the role of artists, or the artist in each one of us,
yes,
to actually take out of this raw material, fashion the new way.
Fashion a new way, behave in a new way, dress, be individual, find out what their identity. All the letters that I get about the diary are usually a problem of who are they. It's really a problem of identity before they can begin to be revolutionary. They're putting, you can't put one before the other. You cannot be a revolutionary unless you know what you are really rebelling for, not against, but for.
Anise, what are the themes of some of your other novels which are implicit in our discussion today? relate to it?
Well,
each one
dealt with a different theme. The theme of the mature woman with the immature young man and children of the albatross. I did try to show the entanglement that Jung spoke about, that there are very few relationships of two, that there's always a third one who plays a ghostly role, who is either the remembered wife or the parent or the relation to the family. In other words, there are interferences to the relationship of two. So I dramatized that. I did dramatize a woman's struggle against the legend built about her goodness. And there comes a moment in one of the novels when Juno examines this goodness and says, well, it isn't goodness at all. I really don't feel that. This was imposed on me. I treated a great deal of subjects which women had been convinced of. For example, the emotional disturbance during the period. And frigidity and all kinds of subjects which were tabooed at the time that I wrote the novels. I tried to open up the really unconscious of woman, and I was berated for it because, as someone said to Tennessee too, you show them the monsters that inhabit you and the nightmares to which you are prey, and then they berate you for it. That is, the author becomes the symbol of the character he's describing, which of course is false.
Mm.
But the most important thing as far as the liberation of women, I think, is the diary more than the novels. Because the story of the journey, the organic step-by-step journey, is what we have to learn. That it isn't done in one day, and it isn't done by shouting, and it isn't done even by gaining a position. That it's a very subtle and intricate development. It's a growth of woman.
Lovely spot to end our discussion. Thank you, Anais Nin, for talking to me today at KVFK in our almost finished new studios.